I was sitting there listening to him give his State of the State address, and my jaw dropped.
I thought it was wrong for a number of people to blindside me the day of the vote.
We have a schizophrenic healthcare philosophy.
This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
And I'm Jarrett Murphy from City Limits. If you want to understand more about the challenges facing New York City and hear from people running for office or working on solutions, tune in to Max and Murphy. We'll talk to electeds and candidates, experts and advocates, and then open up the phone lines to hear from you. That's Max and Murphy, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Wait a minute. Indeed, wait a minute, because it's 10 o'clock here in New York City, and you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, Talk Out of School.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
Hello, everyone. My name is Leonie Heemson. Welcome to our show, Talk Out of School, on WBAI Radio, where we'll focus on issues affecting the public schools here in New York City, at the state level, and nationally. We also want to hear from you about what issues you want us to address. Please visit the Class Size Matters Facebook page to add your thoughts, the Talk Out of School Instagram page, or through Twitter with the hashtag TalkOutOfSchool. During the next hour, we'll be talking to Councilmember Mark Traeger of Brooklyn, chair of the New York City Council Education Committee, about the hearings that he held yesterday about testing, high-stakes testing in our schools. In the second half of the program, we'll be talking with Christopher Worth, the intrepid WNYC reporter who on his own inspected the conditions of four New York City public schools and found high levels of lead in cracking paint on the walls and lead dust on the floors. We'll be asking him about what the DOE is doing as a result of his investigations and whether he thinks that's enough. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about the climate strike, which took place last Friday in New York City and throughout the world. Over 4 million people participated, most of them young people, to bring attention to what many believe is the existential crisis of our time. This week, the focus continues with Climate Week at the UN, and on Monday, a group of 16 young activists from around the world sued Germany, France, Brazil, Argentina, and Turkey for violating children's rights under the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which includes the right to life, health, and peace, with special rights for indigenous groups, which climate change is already affecting. Many of the young plaintiffs are from nations whose very existence is threatened by the rising sea levels caused by climate change. They chose the five countries not because they have the worst records on climate change, but because they had agreed to a process that gives the committee the authority to receive legal complaints for children whose rights have been violated. The U.S., by the way, is the only nation that has never even ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. What's inspiring is not only how engaged and creative and fierce many of these young activists are, but how most of their leaders, including Greta Thunberg of Sweden and Alexandria Villasenor of the U.S., are girls who have taken hold of this critical issue and won't let it go until the leaders of the world take decided action. If you'd like to read the legal complaint and the stories of these young activists who have now sued, you can find them at childrenvsclimatecrisis.org. Now I'd like to introduce Councilmember Mark Traeger, who is the chair of the New York City Education Committee. Councilmember Traeger, are you there?
I am here. Great to be with you this morning.
Thank you so much for coming. Welcome to Talk Out of School, our new WBAI radio show. You held some fascinating hearings yesterday at the City Council on breaking the testing culture at our schools. Can you speak a little bit about what you meant by that term?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Lainey, again, for making the time. I asked Anthony Ramos, who is a graduate of New Utrecht High School, where I used to teach, to share his story, to kind of, you know, summarize and crystallize for the public what does breaking the testing culture mean. This was a student that was labeled as underperforming, quote-unquote, underperforming by our school system. And the irony is he is one of the most talented performers of our time to ever hit the Broadway stage. And so he testified that due to a number of social challenges that he was facing. You know, he had difficulty with certain exams during school. And if it was not for his social worker and if not for his theater teacher, he's not sure if he would have finished school. And he certainly would not have advanced in his career on Broadway. And so that is what I meant by saying that the current assessment structure that is so heavy on high-stakes testing does not really capture the full talents and abilities of our students and actually shortchanges learning. So one of the overarching questions I asked during the course of the hearing, does the education department value learning? Because if they value learning, then the current assessment structure is completely broken and upside down.
So this takes us to the system that we have in New York State called the Regents Exams. Most every
right.
state in the country is ditching their exit exams needed to graduate from high school, but not New York State, where we still rely on, I think, five or six exit exams, though the State
Correct.
Board of Regents are now looking and possibly changing the system and has formed a commission to do so. In contrast, there are a small number of performance-based consortium schools. I think there are 38 with performance-based assessments where children, students actually have to write papers or do projects to pass their courses in the primary four subjects. They also take ELA exams, but no other Regents exams. And you had some really amazing testimony yesterday from students, teachers, and principals at some of those consortium schools. Can you talk a little bit about what they said?
So, absolutely, Lainey. This is probably one of the best-kept secrets within the education department that you have these 38 consortium schools that have been granted a state waiver from administering the high-stakes Regents examination. And in place of the Regents exam, they have something which I feel is actually more rigorous and actually more sophisticated. They're called PBAS, or these performance-based assessments. I visited one recently in my district, the Leaders School, and I sat down with teachers, with students, with school leaders. It is fascinating, the work that they're doing. There's no teaching to just one test. There's year-long, just learning and celebration of learning, and there are benchmarks along the way to monitor student growth and proficiency. And so these consortium schools, for whatever reason, no one's really, talked to them and learned from them and networked with them. And I asked the DOE, why aren't we doing more to learn about some of the amazing work that they're doing? Why are there only 38? Are there more schools interested in advancing this model? What have we learned from them? They've been in existence for over 20 years. And it was mind-boggling to me that they're showing promise in particular subgroups, particularly students with IEPs, multilingual learners. They're showing increased graduation rates than the citywide average in non-consortium schools. And so my question to DOE, what are they doing that we're not in the rest of the school system? And no one was doing that macro analysis. And so, Lainey, I left very impressed with the students and the educators from consortium schools. I think that they are onto some cutting edge learning best practices that we should be applying to the rest of the school system. But what I heard the most from them is that they are not a heavy test culture.
Mm-hmm.
They are a heavy learning culture. They value learning, which is an amazing concept for the education department.
So you have a personal stake in this and personal experience because you yourself were a history teacher, and you had to teach to the Regents. I recently interviewed someone who was also a former history teacher in the New York City public schools, and he bewailed the fact that he had many Haitian students in his school, and he was only able to talk about the history of Haiti and the Haitian Revolution for maybe 20 minutes. And all the students in his class were absolutely fascinated and wanted to learn about it in more depth. But he told me that he was unable to do so because he had to go a mile wide and an inch deep to prepare for the Regents exams. Did you have experiences similar to that?
100%, and he is spot on. Just recently, as you mentioned earlier, thousands of young people took to the streets to demand bold action to combat the biggest crisis facing our planet in climate change. And yet, in the global history, in the history curriculum for high school regions, we're basically told that by March, you have to stop the curriculum and go shift into Regents prep. And so for many global and world history teachers, that usually means that you're somewhere in the World War II curriculum. And so we just stop there and just go right back into Regents prep. And it's as if the world stops at World War II. And you cannot discuss some of the most pressing current issues of our time. And so that teacher is spot on correct. The Regents, it is so limiting in terms of what you can teach. I like to teach in depth, for students to become critical thinkers, independent thinkers. It's just everything is about covering material, moving fast, on to the next thing. And so that doesn't value learning. And so many times I was told that my lesson was great, but the question is that going to be on the Regents?
Right.
And, you know, I remember, Lainey, also a couple of years ago, the powerful film of Selma. Remember Selma, that powerful
sure.
film that hit the movie theaters?
Yeah.
Ask history teachers how many times, or if any, was there a question on Selma on the Regents? I don't recall.
Incredible.
I don't recall.
Even in U.S. so, history, they didn't deal with the civil rights movement and the actual events.
I mean, there might have been a different question just at one period, but mm-hmm. I don't think Selma was mentioned. And so the curriculum, there's no question, needs to be more culturally responsive.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be able to discuss climate change. By the way, one of the projects that the students were working on at the Leaders Consortium School is the issue of climate change,
right.
which they're going in depth on. I applaud them because thing is, Lainey, this system is just trying to produce test takers. We need to produce problem solvers to help solve some of the most pressing problems of our time.
Right. Well, one of the most surprising things, I mean, there was a lot of great testimony yesterday, but some of the most surprising testimony came from Linda Chen, who's the chief academic officer of the DOE, and she wasn't able to answer a lot of your questions, in my view, and evaded some of the questions. And then when you asked her whether it was true what we'd heard, that DOE is going to implement a new standardized testing system 4 times a year across the system, she admitted that that was true. And it was just, you know, somewhat shocking to me. This was a hearing on breaking the testing culture, and they admitted that they're going to really be imposing more standardized testing on our schools, not less. I go far enough back. I remember when the DOE paid for acuity interim assessments, which they bought from McGraw for $22 million a year. And after a few years, it was dropped because nobody believed that it was helpful in any sense. It wasn't aligned with the curriculum. It wasn't predictive. It caused more stress. It caused more wasted time on standardized testing. And sometimes I feel like we're in this endless Groundhog's Day loop, that no administration learns from the past mistakes, and we just continue to make the same mistakes over and over. I wonder what you think about this proposal.
You know, the irony was not lost on me either, Lainey, that mm-hmm. we're having a hearing and a discussion on the negative impacts of a hyper-test culture in our school system, and there are plans within DOE to impose and to administer another exam on students. And I said to them, rather than pay for, probably it was going to be another costly initiative, why don't you pick up the phone and give a call to a teacher and ask them how their students are doing and where they need more help and support. That will save them money, that will save them headaches, and that will save them bad press.
Right.
It is unbelievable to me,
mm-hmm.
unbelievable to me, that they are thinking of imposing another exam, knowing already how detrimental the current testing culture is for our students. And again, see, Lainey, I'm a former teacher, so they can't get away with this with me. teachers, we have to trust our teachers. They know our kids. Parents, families know their children. Mm-hmm. They need to speak to teachers. They need to trust teachers. Mm-hmm. Because when I visit schools and I speak to teachers and I speak to school leaders and parents, what I'm being asked for is, can you increase, in addition to reducing class size, which is one of the biggest, and I applaud you for, you have been, you know, pounding on this issue for as long as I've known you, Lainey, and I applaud you on that. But they're also asking for increased social emotional support. Mm-hmm. In the elementary schools in particular, where the state does not even require a guidance counselor, schools are asking, can you help fund a full-time guidance counselor? Can you lift the freeze on counselors? Can I get a full-time social worker? That's what I'm being asked, in addition to class size and also more art and music as part of the curriculum during the course of the day. So I think sometimes they are in la-la land, and sometimes they are advancing agendas that are not the agendas of our kids, but the agendas of other interests. And my job is to get them to focus on the agenda of our children and their learning.
I really wanted to thank you for mentioning class size. I mean, Anthony Ramos talked about his class sizes of 35 and how that really hampered his experiences in high school. But then you asked Linda Chen whether the DOE had done any analysis looking at whether there's a correlation between test scores and class size. And she said no, which means, of course, they are ignoring some of the most basic important data that affects our kids today. We did an analysis showing that among the renewal schools, those that did reduce class size showed really good results. And those that didn't are still struggling, and some of them had to be closed. I wondered what you think of the EduStat system, which you also touched on yesterday. DOE has had a series of expensive data systems that have been complete fiascos, from ARIS, which cost us $100 million and has now been dropped, CSIS at nearly $100 million and has now been dropped. The idea that we're going to invest in another expensive data system, which wasn't clear to me what the function was, what the data that they'd be collecting would be, and what the point of it all is. What do you think about EduStat?
So, Lainey, I had to take two Advils when I got home last night. I will be honest with you and your listeners. I had a long day yesterday. First of all, I lived through the ARIS debacle. And I remember when the DOE was selling ARIS the way they were trying to sell EduStat yesterday at the hearing. You know, all mm-hmm. this comprehensive, fancy data, you know, this whole new system, and now the chancellor is using the term, which I don't even know what this means, dipstick terminology, about knowing where kids are and trying to figure this out. First of all, I again go back to my suggestion a few seconds ago. Pick up a phone. We have amazing technology in the 21st century, Lainey. pick up your cell phone or send an email. And why don't you ask a teacher? Mm-hmm. You have amazing educators who work for the system every day.
Yeah.
They have what's called a grade book, or now they call it scheduler. They have these new things. When I left teaching, they have new fancy ways of keeping records. Teachers keep notes, teachers have records, and you call them and you will find out where their kids are and what supports. The question the DOE needs to ask itself is, what can I do more to better support our schools? Not to regurgitate what we already know.
Right. Well, I would add one thing, which is also ask the parents and listen to the parents who say that reducing class size is either the number one or the number two priority for their schools. And teachers also tend to agree in surveys that this would be the most effective way to improve their opportunity for success as well as their students. You asked some terrific questions.
You are spot on.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say that you asked a lot of terrific questions yesterday, and you were very, very on target in my mind. But one of the parents had a really good question for you, which was Kamala Kit Carmen actually said, it's great that you're holding these hearings, and we appreciate it so much in bringing attention to this issue. But given mayoral control, the city council has limited authority to affect school policy. And you responded, I think, quite appropriately that we want to bring more attention to this issue, and this is one way of doing it and putting pressure on DOE, even if you can't necessarily directly change their direction in terms of testing.
Yeah.
But my question is something that I've always really wanted to ask someone at the council, and I hope you can answer it. We know that the council does have some authority through the budget process and negotiations to add funding for certain programs that they feel are a priority. And you guys added funding for counselors last year, and you added funding...
Social workers, last year.
Yeah. And the year before, you added money to Fair Student Funding to bring up the floor to 90%. Can you use that same... negotiating ability to cut things from the budget? For example, if the DOE says they want to buy a new expensive interim testing system or a new expensive data system, both of which are probably useless, can the city council say, no, we're not going to allow that in the budget for next year?
So these are excellent questions, and there's no easy answer to that other than we have to work hard at trying to negotiate these things. As you understand, we are limited by our authority because education is a creature of the state, and so the state grants the mayor mayoral control. I was one of the few members, if one member, that testified to make changes to mayoral control. Mm-hmm. But having said that, we have used the power of the bully pulpit, I think, effectively to advance certain priorities. You mentioned social workers. Over 200 full-time social workers in the last budget. We also, I think, helped to some extent try to stabilize the early childhood education system by trying to get a pathway to parity for early childhood educators. In the last budget, with the Fair Student Funding, we pushed for Fair Student Funding increase. But what we learned, Lainey, was that the majority of the $125 million was used to actually retain teachers in their schools and not to excess them, which I think maybe helps stabilize class size, but not certainly make a dramatic impact in reducing class size. So the answer to your question is all of this has to come through negotiations. If, for example, with Thrive NYC, I was very critical of the fact that the DOE was spending millions of dollars to Thrive for folks that are not licensed to provide direct services to our children. So we did get them to redirect $11 million to hire 85 clinical social workers who I met with actually yesterday at the UFT prior to the hearing, and I was so inspired by that meeting. So it's all subject to negotiations. It's subject to their priorities, our priorities, and that's a part of the budget process. But I will tell you this. I have not yet been briefed on EduStat. Mm-hmm. I have not yet been briefed on this new formative assessment, which I'm thinking of. I am insisting on a briefing on learning what exactly this is about, how much does this cost, and, you know, I will be asking all those tough questions. And I reserve the right, you know, to inform the speaker, inform my colleagues that I think this might be another expensive waste of taxpayer money, mm-hmm. when in reality, if we had... You know, Lainey, if we had $100 million rather than spend it on ARIS, imagine how many counselors, teachers, social workers you could fund with that type of money, which actually will make a difference in reducing class size and addressing the social-emotional needs of our students. Right now, that's where I think some of the most critical pressing needs are. And so I asked the question yesterday, how much does this cost? Mm-hmm. They didn't give me an answer.
Right.
I am insisting on an answer. And so there's more work to do here, Lainey.
Right. Well, I originally wanted to have you come on to talk about your agenda for the year in terms of oversight hearings and legislation, but I was just so captivated by the hearings yesterday and all the issues that it provoked. I really wanted to focus on that. I'm hoping that you can come back on another show and talk about your plans for the year. Meanwhile, we have Christopher Wirth, a intrepid reporter who broke the story about how many classrooms were contaminated with lead. And he would like to ask you a question about that issue, which is also of very pressing importance. Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely, sure.
Christopher. Hey. Good morning, Councilmember Traeger.
Good morning, Chris.
Good to speak with you again. The question I wanted to ask you is, you know, the last time you and I spoke, we talked about the possibility of the City Council holding hearings or at least part of a hearing on lead in city schools. And I wanted to ask you whether or not there is any update about when that hearing might take place.
Yes. So there will be a hearing. The only addition I would add is that I think that there will be more committees involved, not just the education committee. This is going to turn into even a bigger, broader, more comprehensive discussion about the city's response to lead in schools and other parts of our city institutions. So I think that that is happening. It's going to be even bigger, more comprehensive, with the support of the speaker in his office, who has been, they've been very helpful in helping us tie this all together. Listen, they had my back on the issue of making sure that we test in the common spaces and the cluster rooms in schools as well, which we heard that they now have a reversal on their position. Originally, they didn't want to test the common spaces, but I still need to be briefed about that as well. And so that's all going to come out as a course of our hearing as well. So yes, that is still on our full agenda, Chris. And it's going to be a more, even broader, more comprehensive hearing beyond just the school system.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. I just want to also put in a plug for my issue, class size. We would love to have hearings on class size. We haven't in a number of years. And as you know, it is an incredibly important issue to most parents and teachers. Now we have to take a break. I want to thank you again profusely for coming on the show and hope that you can come on again, because the work that you're doing is so important and I think so illuminating to so many people.
Well, Lainey, I want to thank you and Christopher, because your work helps really, highlight these areas of critical need in our city, in our school system. You hold folks accountable. You speak truth to power. So I want to thank both of you for your work as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a few minutes with Christopher Wirth talking about lead in the schools.
Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke, John, you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance.
Kindly write down this reminder to yourself. Saturday, the 16th of November. Yes, November 16th, 2019. An extraordinary experience will come your way. Prepare yourself.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance.
feeling the music from head to toe.
Hi, this is Talk Out of School with Leanne Hameson on WBAI-FM 99.5 Pacifica Radio. We were talking earlier with Councilmember Mark Traeger about high-stakes testing in our schools, and now we're talking with Christopher Wirth, who is here with us in the studio. Christopher is the WNYC reporter who is the first person that I know of to actually go into our schools and classrooms and carefully look to see whether they had cracking lead paint and lead dust on the floors, even though DOE is supposed to have been doing this annually. Christopher, thank you for being here. Can you tell us how you first got the idea to go into classrooms to investigate this issue and then what you found?
Yeah, so last year, the City Council introduced several pieces of legislation, Councilmember Mark Traeger included, to deal and tighten the regulations that we have around lead exposure in New York City. And so that was WNYC made a commitment to cover this issue. And so I became very steeped in it. It wasn't something that I knew a lot about before. And as I was covering these bills and following their progress, my daughter started first grade in a DOE school building that was constructed in 1895 and could use some tender, loving care, I have to say. And so I went into, you know, the early days of school, I was inside of her classroom, and I noticed, you know, against one wall, a really large radiator that was covered in cracked peeling paint with paint chips underneath it. And so while I was in the class, I went over and I picked up one of those paint chips and I put it in a little plastic baggie I happened to have in my backpack. And I had been working with a lab to do some other testing around some other reporting that we were doing. And I sent it to the lab and I said, can you please test this paint chip for lead? It came back. I got the analysis a couple days later and it was loaded with lead. It was about 10 to 11 times what our current New York City standard is for what we consider lead paint. And this was lying on the floor of a first grade classroom. And I had seen the paint conditions in the rest of the building. And so this got me curious about what are our protocols around this? Why is there peeling paint in a New York City classroom, given what we know about lead exposure in kids? These are the places where we concentrate our children. Mm-hmm. And I started asking DOE, what are your protocols? We did not get a response, even though we tried repeatedly to get them to send us, what are the protocols? How do you deal with this? What, you know, kind of inspections take place?
Because there is some sort of requirement that they be inspecting?
Well, so the health code, the city's health code requires an annual visual inspection. Mm-hmm. So we have in New York City what's called Local Law 1, but those regulations, you know, they require remediation of lead paint in people's homes, and they primarily apply to private landlords. They mm-hmm. do not apply to the schools. They're the most rigorous standards we have in the city, but they do not apply to our school buildings. And the health code does require annual visual inspections. So we did not get a response from DOE, and that's when I reached out to over 30. I made a spreadsheet of schools built before 1960, which is when the New York City banned lead paint, mm-hmm. Even though we have documentation that the Department of Education continued to use lead paint in New York City schools until around 1980.
Oh, my God.
But I focused on those older schools, reached out to over 30 of them, school principals, PTAs. Can we come in? Can I take this kind of testing? I worked with the lab that WNYC used to learn how to properly take what is called a lead dust sample, which mm-hmm. is kind of like using a baby wipe, and you swab a section of floor and you send it off to a lab and you can find out exactly how much lead dust is on the floor there. We have standards for these things in New mm-hmm. York City. And so just four, I was able to successfully get into four schools.
How many did you ask to begin with?
Over 30. Okay. Over 30 schools we approached. Most people, most school principals, most PTAs, they said, we do not want to run afoul of DOE policy here. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, we're sure that this is an important issue, but we can't let you in. But I did manage to.
Did they say you should go to DOE first?
Of course, yeah, many of them did. Many of them did, uh-huh. Yeah, even though that had proved to be a dead end.
Right.
But the schools that we were able to get into, all of them showed that there were very high levels of lead dust. Mm-hmm. Not only lead dust, but peeling lead paint. The paint chips that we were able to obtain, which were loose paint chips on floors, also came back with very high levels of lead.
And so what happened after you wrote about this and went on the radio to sort of expose the situation? How did DOE react initially, and what did they do subsequently?
Well, so it was kind of a dual response from DOE and the mayor. And at first, the response was one of incredulity. The mayor expressed, you know, concern that I, as a reporter, was not an EPA-certified inspector, which is true. But I did follow EPA guidelines. There is actually, you know, research that has been done to show how far off are samples collected by an EPA-certified person and a non-EPA-certified person. And they found that there's about a 90-95% congruency rate, meaning that the lay people can collect these samples if they do them in the proper way that the EPA sets out.
And this is in the context of both the mayor running for president at that time,
yeah,
and also the scandal around NYSHA and the housing authority and the levels of lead in many of the apartments, which initially they said they had remediated, but then and inspected, and it turned out they hadn't. So
that's right.
Already the mayor had a lead problem on his hands politically.
Right. And because of that city council legislation, lead had become elevated as an issue in New York City at that point in time. But the DOE did decide, and we were told that this was out of an abundance of caution, to go in and take a look at those schools. They said that they had been following the DOE or the health code, and that those annual visual inspections had been taking place. But out of an abundance of caution, they were going to do it again at the end of the school year and just see what was there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the course of the summer, as those inspections were taking place, the end result was that over 1,800 classrooms out of about 8,000, so it's about 21% of the classrooms that were inspected, were found to have active lead paint hazards in those classrooms, which means that there was peeling lead paint in a classroom. And DOE is only focusing on classrooms that have children 6 years of age and younger. So what that means is 3K through first grade classrooms.
And they look at classrooms for younger children because...
The focus is on younger children, classrooms with younger children, because what we know is that as the brain is developing, it's these younger children who are very much susceptible to the effects of lead. So we know that lead causes a loss of IQ, even at what we now consider, you know, what are now relatively low levels compared to what lead exposure used to look like in the past. We know that even those low levels of exposure cause loss of IQ, hyperactivity, and many associated behavioral problems.
Right. And in fact, as low as you can measure lead in the blood, it's associated with both academic and behavioral problems.
That's right.
Statistically.
The CDC says that no level of lead is safe.
No measurable.
Right. That's right. No measurable lead.
But the DOE didn't do a few things that you and other experts had recommended that they do. For example, they were still not inspecting the levels of lead dust on the floor. Is that right? And many of the issues arise when young children are on the floor. We have, in most of our elementary schools, we have of story time. I forget exactly what it's called now since my kids have grown up, where they sit on the rug and they engage in reading books and discussing things. And they get that dust in their hands, and then they also put their hands in their mouth often. So lead dust, because it's even more soluble than cracking lead paint, can be very dangerous. And the other thing that initially the DOE refused to do was to analyze and inspect common areas like lunchrooms, for example, or gyms. Is that right?
That's right. So the DOE, I want parents and others to understand how the inspection process works and what exactly the DOE did over the summer. The way that this has worked is that a school custodian will do a visual survey of the school building in those specified classrooms. If they see deteriorated paint, so it's up to what their definition of is of deteriorated paint, then a separate third-party inspector will come in and use what's called an XRF machine, which is a portable, it's almost like a grocery store scanner, but it can read the exact lead content of a painted surface, even through, you know, down to older layers of lead, of paint. and they'll analyze that deteriorated paint. And then any peeling paint that was determined to be lead-based was then assigned to be remediated over the summer. So it was over 1,800 classrooms, and the DOE says that it has successfully remediated those. But what you should understand is that what we're talking about is remediation of just those specific areas of deteriorated lead paint. So there's not a lot of, you know, active remediation of what could potentially in the future turn out to be a lead paint problem in a classroom. But yes, you're right. There was not any kind of analysis of what the lead dust levels were. And as we know, it's that lead dust that is immediately soluble to the blood, and that it is actually, the health department has identified as the largest, the biggest risk and the biggest contributor to blood lead levels in New York City.
So, and the issue of the common rooms, which now they supposedly are starting to analyze?
Yes. So at first, DOE did not want to test common rooms, even though the health code does say that any areas that those kids six and under occupy or utilize in a school building should also be inspected. What DOE has now since said is that they will start to inspect and remediate libraries and cafeterias, and that work should be completed by the beginning of the next school year.
So I've spoken to one of the preeminent lead experts of our time, Dr. Maury Markowitz from Montefiore Hospital, and he also says that not just common rooms, but all the rooms in schools should be inspected for lead, because even if they're not young children in that room, there is still ability to track the lead dust from room to room. And also that kids at all ages are vulnerable to the effects of lead, not just younger children, though of course we worry about young children the most because of the greatest effect on cognitive ability, but also the fact that they, hand-to-mouth behavior is most prevalent. But one of the things that I've also been very concerned about, even before your reporting, was the issue of lead in the water at DOE schools. A couple years ago, the state passed a new law that had new requirements and regulations about how lead in water must be tested, the protocol for testing the lead in the water, and the action level of 15 parts per billion, after which there needs to be remediation of those water outlets in school. Most recently, after their third round of testing and remediation, DOE recently released their findings showing that more than 80% of all the schools tested had at least one outlet exceeding that action level, with over 2,400 fixtures exuding lead at above essentially illegal levels. And some that they looked at actually had more than 13,000 parts per billion, which is, you know, nearly 1,000 times higher than the legal limit. On our blog, New York City Parent Blog, we have a spreadsheet and list of the highest levels of water, of schools with the highest levels of lead in the water. I just wanted to mention that you can go on that website and check out your own school. Prospect Heights High School was the one where they had more than 13 parts per billion and a fourth floor boys' bathroom and a hallway water fountain on the third floor of more than 3,000 parts per billion. And so Dr. Markowitz actually told me that under certain circumstances, lead in the water can even be more toxic, for example, than peeling lead paint, because it is already dissolved and can be most readily absorbed into the blood. And so I'm wondering what you think about the protocols, because these are all fountains which were already inspected and already said to be remediated last year.
Right. I think, you know, if you talk to engineers who work on this issue, what they'll tell you is that you can test one water source 1 month, and then 2 months later, you can test that same water source and you will get a very different reading. Because what you're talking about are tiny particles of lead that are either breaking free from the piping or from the solder or from the fixture itself, and that are entering the water. And so it's very variable. And so just testing it one time, which is why DOE will continue to test these sources, testing it one time does not clear any single fountain. A fountain can test at 14 and it would be passed. And that gets us to this question of what exactly are our standards telling us to do? 15 parts per billion, as you mentioned, is the federal standard. It's the standard that New York State follows. But that standard was created in the early 90s and is not a health-based standard. It is just a standard that tells, you know, water companies what is possible and what might be possibly hazardous. But if you look at other states have adopted a level, even Michigan has done this, a level of 5 parts per billion in terms of when you need to remediate a fixture. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends in schools that any fountain that tests above 1 part per billion be remediated immediately. So, you know, the fact that the CDC says that no level of lead exposure is safe tells us that even that 15 parts per billion is not necessarily keeping our children safe.
Right. I also spoke to Joan Matthews of the National Resources Defense Council. They have a model bill that would actually lower the action level in schools to 1 part per billion. And what she told me was that Vermont has a statewide limit of 4 parts per billion, Washington, D.C. and Illinois, 5 parts per billion. And that compares again to New York State, 15 parts per billion. And as Christopher just said, there is no measurable level of lead in the blood which is safe. And all levels of that are measurable have been correlated over statistically with lower levels of IQ and behavior problems. One of the things that the NRDC bill also does was that it would require filtration systems at every single drinking water outlet in New York City public schools, or again, any public school across the state, because in her view and the view of many experts, filtration is the best and the most reliable way of getting lead out of our water. Because as Christopher said, you know, you can test different levels of lead at different times without the filtration. Do you have any thoughts about that bill and whether it should be seriously considered or not?
Well, I mean, I won't comment on the bill itself. I think that there are some serious questions about what our safety standards should be. It does indicate that 15 parts per billion, which was, as I say, a level that was created in the 90s when the CDC was still following very different guidelines around what we considered to be an elevated lead level in children. You know, it's gone from 10 micrograms per deciliter in children to 5 micrograms per deciliter. So our definitions around levels in children have changed, and it probably tells us that our definitions around what an acceptable lead level in water should also change. You know, we did an analysis of recently the Parks Department tested all of the public drinking fountains over the summer. We did an analysis of those results. The city is obviously following 15 parts per billion. Around 8% of all the fountains tested had elevated lead levels above 15. But when you look at the smaller amounts, it was somewhere around 16-17% of the fountains did not pass the 5 parts per billion test, and around 51% did not pass the 1 part per billion test.
So it would obviously be a very expensive legislation to comply with. But when it comes to our children's health, one might argue that in the end it's worth it. Can you speak a little bit about the research also that's been done looking at the relationship between crime levels over time and levels of lead in blood?
Yeah, you know, I haven't dug into this to a great extent, but there is some very credible research. You know, crime rates declined precipitously towards the end of the 1990s and extending into the early parts of the 2000s. And, you know, there have been lots of possible explanations for that. You know, one is broken windows, policing. There are all kinds of, you know, and many have been refuted. But there's some very credible research that shows that as the legislation in that came into effect in the 1970s that banned lead paint, that phased lead out of gasoline, which was a major contributor to blood lead levels in this country. As those, the effect of that legislation started to result in declining blood lead levels. So in 1977, when I was born, the median blood lead level in children was 15 micrograms per deciliter. That is now considered an emergency blood lead level in New York City. It is now down much further. You know, blood lead levels have declined over 90%. And as that decline has happened, if you lag that about 20 years, what you find is that as the kids who benefited the most from that legislation, which were kids who were born in that period when we had that legislation, as they became young adults, we saw those blood lead levels drop. And we know that lead exposure is associated with, as we've said, aggression, behavioral problems, these sorts of things. So there's some very credible research that links these two things together. And it may not be primarily lead, but lead does seem to be a contributor.
So I've also looked at some of the data around the achievement gap in schools and testing, and there was an increase among all groups, but particularly low-income groups in the 1970s. And I reached out to one of the researchers on this, and I said, you really should look at lead as well as a possible contributor. Mm. And he said that was a good idea. I don't know that anyone has actually done that yet. Do you have advice first for the DOE and then for parents about what should be done, aside from new legislation, to address this problem more efficiently and more effectively?
Well, you mentioned Dr. Markowitz. You know, he does have concerns, and many other people who I've spoken with have concerns around the cutoff that we have designated for six and under, that we're not checking the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth grade classrooms. Again, that 6 years of age is a rather arbitrary number. We know that as kids start to lose their teeth, there's a lot of hand-to-mouth activity there, and kids start to lose their teeth in those upper grades. My daughter just started second grade, and we had curriculum night about 2 weeks ago, and I was in her classroom, and I could visibly see peeling paint coming off the ceiling. I found a paint chip on the floor. I sent it off to the lab. It was 20 times our current New York City standard.
Is your child's school one of the ones that was inspected and found to have high levels of lead?
Yes. Yes. Okay. That school, I did test that school. That's PS110. Mm-hmm. But that is, one of among
and
many,
that's
many,
after
many schools.
Remediation. Presumably.
This is after remediation in this because second grade classrooms were not addressed.
Oh, because second grade, yeah.
Second grade classrooms were not addressed, so there was active peeling paint and a lead paint chip perfectly accessible to a child in a second grade classroom. And I think we need to ask ourselves, what do we think is acceptable as we're sending kids into these buildings? I've had many parents contact me with their concerns. They've shown me evidence of peeling paint and accessible paint chips in their classrooms, even after remediation. This is since school has resumed this fall. I think my advice would be that we do need to seriously consider testing and checking the entire school, because lead paint, lead dust, it can be tracked into other parts of the building. Children who are 7 and 8 and 9, they are also susceptible. If parents are concerned and you're in an old class or you're in an old building and you check that, there's a spreadsheet that you can go onto DOE's website and find out if your school, if your specific classroom was identified with a lead paint hazard. If you're concerned, doctors, physicians very much recommend, even if your child is 7, 8, or 9, or 6, that you get your child tested at least once a year for blood lead.
Right. NRDC has also on their website advice for parents, among other things, besides annual testing, which personally I would do if I had a child in one of these schools at any age. They recommend sending your kids to school with water from a filtered source daily, a reusable container with a filter certified to reduce lead. Ask the school principal whether the drinking water has been tested for lead and what the results are, and advocate that your school district install certified filters. And again, as Christopher said, there is this place on the DOE website that if you see peeling paint or dust on the floor that looks like it could be from paint, enter that information in online, and also contact other people like Christopher or like me to make sure that we can follow up and see whether that actually is an effective way of triggering further inspections and remediations, because often parents find that is not necessarily, DOE is so responsive to that. One of the points that Dr. Markowitz made to me also is that children of all ages bite their nails. And if your kid bites your nails, that's another possible source of lead if they got the lead dust on their fingers. So we're coming to an end now. We have to sign off. We hope that this is Talk Out of School on WBA 99.5 FM, Pacifica Radio. We hope that you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next Wednesday at 10 a.m., where our co-host Carol Burris will be asking, should the U.S. preserve our democratically governed public schools, or should schooling become a consumer good that is bought and sold, as suggested by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos? If you like the show, don't forget to sign up online as a BAI buddy for Talk Out of School, and thanks for listening in.
Up to the corner and round the bend, right to the juke joint you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old. Drums loud and bold. Rock, rock, rock and roll.
We've got our friends at CNN here. You guys love breaking news, and you did it. You broke it. I think what no one in this room wants to admit is that Trump has helped all of you. He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric, but he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
We're with you, Michelle Wolf, but if corporate media has got you down, maybe you should try WBAI. We're listener-supported community radio, questioning the mainstream narratives trumpeted by the news profiteers. But in order for this whole thing to work, we need your help. Please go to give2wbai.org to find out how you can support WBAI, or call 516-620-3602. And thanks for supporting Free Speech Radio on WBAI New York.
So, hello, this is John Kane from Let's Talk. With Indigenous Peoples Day still lingering in the shadows of Columbus Day, we have the perfect event to close out the summer. Join Shawnee Rice and I for a free screening of Even the Rain, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, September 26th at the Brooklyn Commons. The film uses a great storyline to address Columbus, his horrific treatment of Indigenous peoples, and how much of that abuse continues today. Come early for some meet and greet, and hang with us after to discuss the film. The event is free, but donations to WBAI are welcome and encouraged. That's Thursday, September 26th, 7:30 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York.
I was sitting there listening to him give his State of the State address, and my jaw dropped.
I thought it was wrong for a number of people to blindside me the day of the vote.
We have a schizophrenic healthcare philosophy.
This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
And I'm Jarrett Murphy from City Limits. If you want to understand more about the challenges facing New York City and hear from people running for office or working on solutions, tune in to Max and Murphy. We'll talk to electeds and candidates, experts and advocates, and then open up the phone lines to hear from you. That's Max and Murphy, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
WBAI is not only a progressive free speech radio station, but it is also your opportunity for several perks through the BAI Buddy System. Becoming a buddy is simple. Donate as little as $10 on a monthly basis, thus forming a relationship that benefits you, the listener, and us here at 99.5 FM. After becoming a buddy, you'll receive a WBAI tote bag and a membership card that enables you to enjoy discounted services at Zipcar, Bacchus French Bistro, Revolution Books, and more locations in the New York region. Simply visit give2, the number 2, WBAI.org. That's give